I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm going to be speaking today with Eli Misdal. He's the justice correspondent at The Nation magazine. We're going to talk about the movement for racial justice and the Trump bar assault on the Constitution and the rule of law. And you can learn more about Eli's work at thenation.com. The show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA, streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, most major podcast sites, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net, TerrenceMcNally.net. There are 95 days from today until what has long been called Election Day. But if you're thinking of voting by mail, with the post office now led by a Trump crony, I think we'd be wise to give ourselves a two-week margin. So instead of thinking of Election Day, November 3rd, let's think of Vote by Mail, October 20th. I encourage you to get involved not only with candidate campaigns, but also with efforts to fight voter suppression and assure that all Americans have their right to vote. This will, as I said, be more challenging in this time of pandemic. And make sure, look for, hit up your representatives to make sure that all Americans can vote by mail and learn about the need to fund the U.S. Postal Service, which has been hit hard by the loss of business mail and the attacks of the Trump administration. As we confront the coronavirus pandemic, I encourage you also to do your part by social distancing, wearing a mask in public, finding ways to help those in your community hurt most by the social isolation and the economic devastation that's now unfolding. And finally, as we continue to make our voices heard against racism and police brutality and for justice and inclusion, please do your part to keep this campaign alive, whether it's showing up on the streets when that happens in your town or helping with organizing or fundraising or just taking on the deep reflection or habit building in your personal life and with those closest to you. Now to today's conversation. Eli Misdal is justice correspondent for The Nation magazine, as I said. So what's going on in the justice arena these days? Well, the Trump bar Justice Department is actively and obviously working for the president and his election campaign. The most corrupt president in memory, more corrupt, I believe, than Nixon, if only because Nixon seemed at times to pursue other goals besides corruption, self-dealing. The most corrupt president served by the most corrupt attorney general. The militarization of local police over the past decade, mixed with a population that owns a lot of guns and a culture of systemic racism and anti-immigrant passion, has produced a dangerous brew. And the pandemic has elicited, I think, in many of us, a sense of shared vulnerability. So that when George Floyd was murdered in a 17-year-old girl shot video, we witnessed it together and we responded with the largest sustained demonstrations in our nation's history, the Black Lives Matter protests to defund the police and reimagine public safety. The Trump bar administration responded with troops and federal police, first in D.C., then in Portland. And I think it's safe to say that our election is under threat, not just in terms of voting and counting, though those are both endangered, but even whether Trump will accept the outcome. Add to that a federal court system and a Supreme Court packed with young Federalist Society trained and nurtured judges, we've got a lot to talk about. As I said, Eli Misdal is the nation's justice correspondent covering the courts, the criminal justice system, and politics, as well as writing the monthly column Objection. He's a graduate of Harvard and Harvard Law, and he was for 12 years the executive editor of Above the Law. Welcome, Eli Misdal, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you so much for having me, Terrence. And let me just say that if everybody did what you said that told them to do in your opening, I wouldn't have a job, right? Everybody just voted and fought racism, I wouldn't need me, right?
Well, sadly, I think you have job security.
Unfortunately, right?
Exactly. Good news, bad news, right? And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Friday, July 31st. First of all, Eli, how are you doing? Where do you live? What's the pandemic like these days where you are? How are you doing?
Yeah, so I live at one of the initial ground zeros of the coronavirus in America. I live in Westchester County, just outside of New York. So we got it here early. I took precautions early. I mean, I was one of those people who, I am not a conspiracy theorist. I do not, I'm not a QAnon person. But I took this seriously, Well, you know, in January and February, basically operating under the assumption that we were being led by a racist, incompetent idiot. And what would it look like if a racist, incompetent idiot was in charge of a global virus response? That's what I was thinking in January. I kind of stocked up in February, and to be honest, I have been outside, you know, in public, wearing a mask twice since March 6th. My children have been outside in public zero times since March 6th. I will go out a third time this weekend. I've got a personal thing that I can't miss. I've got a third mask wearing public time this weekend coming up. But other than that, I have been on lockdown. My family's been on lockdown. My mother lives with us. She's almost 70, and so we've taken it seriously, kind of from all angles, and so we're safe. My community and my country, less so.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it's interesting, given your, I'll call it persona in writing and in speaking, I wonder if people would have said, well, he looks really cautious, but I commend you. I commend you. I myself confess that I masked, my wife and I walk our dog, every afternoon. We live a couple blocks from the beach in Long Beach, California, and we go down there, we keep our distance, we wear our mask, but I'm out, I guess, in public almost every day.
Our cute little dog passed in January, and definitely if she had been with us, we were doing a lot of vet visits all throughout the winter.
You would have been had that not happened. Well,
like, yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. And again, Terrence, it wasn't caution that inspired me. It was understanding what we're up against with this president. And I think that, you know, I think that's a good way to kind of start our conversation, because I feel like so many people kind of say that Trump is a unique threat to democracy, kind of mouth the words that Trump is something unique and dangerous in American life, but then don't play that tape forward, right? Don't take it to the next level. Don't then anticipate, well, if he really is this bad, what will he do next? They don't anticipate the next bad thing coming around the corner. With coronavirus, it's just an example of where, like, I just read the field, right?
Yeah.
I just saw the whole board.
Yeah, no, I agree, and I think you're right. Yeah, that's not an excess of caution. It's a sufficient amount of realism.
Right.
I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas we talk about. We've got an hour. And so, briefly, how do you see your path to the work you're doing these days? And you can go way back, mentors, turning points, moments of decision along the way, so we get a sense of Elie Mystal.
Oh.
Yeah?
Well, I was a corporate lawyer, making a lot of money. And at a Manhattan law firm, I made more money. I made more money at 27 years old than I do now.
Of course.
So I was kind of living that life, living the dream, if you will. And it just, I didn't like it. It wasn't that I was bad at it, although I wasn't great at it, I'm not gonna lie. I was working on, I can't tell the specific, because of disclosure rules, I can't tell the specifics of the case, but it was basically a big, bad company doing bad things to a nation in Africa. And I was not representing the African nation's government. I was representing part of the team representing the big bad company. And I was working on this case. And I was just like, man, the ancestors did not die so that I could do this. Right? Like this was, there was so much struggle and effort and work that went into getting me to Harvard and getting me to Harvard Law School and putting me in a position to, you know, to be who I am. So much, you know, biological, emotional, and certainly financial investment went into me that this was not what it was all supposed to be about, right? That's not why all those people sacrificed. Yeah. And so I quit. I didn't know what I wanted to do next. I played Madden football for about 6 months. I was really good at it. And I kind of realized that.
But then you realize they didn't go through all that sacrifice and suffering for Madden football either.
Exactly. I wasn't better. And I eventually kind of got into writing. My job at Above the Law that you mentioned, I won that job, actually, the contest, the writing contest where the readers got to vote us off every week. And I won my position there. And kind of that started my career. My focus on how I kind of came to The Nation and Justice and talking about these issues at this time, you know, I've always been kind of interested in the Supreme Court. It's one of the things that I liked about law school, was kind of understanding the Supreme Court and the federal courts, how they work and what their decisions mean for people on the ground. And I feel like a lot of court reporting, especially Supreme Court reporting, kind of stays in the clouds, stays in these kind of very esoteric kind of theories and philosophies of law. And even in the report, in the journalistic bar, they don't do a great job of explaining how these decisions are going to impact real people on the ground every day. Part of it is because the Supreme Court journalistic bar is predominantly, overwhelmingly white and very skewed male. So when they're taking away your rights, right? When they're taking away your voting rights or your right to marry or your school choice, when they're taking away all those rights, the people whose rights they're taking away aren't in the room reporting on what's happening. And I think that's one of the reasons why Supreme Court discussion tends to stay in the clouds. It's not their houses that are their homes that are under threat.
Yeah.
It's my home. It's my people. It's my wife's people who are getting the short end of the Supreme Court stick. And so when I kind of got as I grew in my career, the opportunity to explain the Supreme Court through my eyes, through the eyes of an other, still with all the kind of legal training and legalistic knowledge and whatever, but, you know, through the lens of how that was going to affect people who look like me.
Yeah.
And who believe what I believe. That's really what's motivated certainly the current invocation of my career.
Yeah. So as we talked about, you were editor for 12 years of Above the Law. I love the fact that you won it in sort of an American Idol kind of contest. Great. Very American. but for folks who are not aware of it, what is it? And what did you learn in that role?
So Above the Law is a niche website that's been extremely successful, kind of doing inside baseball news and analysis for actual lawyers, right? So our audience on Above the Law is overwhelmingly active practicing attorneys, law students, judges, and then some paralegals and secretaries and people like that, right? Like that's, I just described 95% of that audience.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're talking to a kind of a relatively well-educated, knowledgeable audience about what lawyers talk about around the water cooler, right? So the site would be either, one of the reasons why we make money, why we get readers, is that, we talk about salaries and who's up and who's down and who's getting fired and which firms are job secure, right? Like that's just straight up B2B industry news. I was kind of more on the analysis wing. But again, even that, it was analysis in a way that lawyers talk about these cases, right? So very kind of personality driven analysis, right? Like, when one of my favorite stories was linking up Stephen Breyer's, that's a liberal justice of the Supreme Court, linking up his opinions on basically criminal justice, defendants' rights, pre him being mugged and post him being mugged.
Yeah,
Breyer got mugged in the Bahamas in the 2000s. And there's a difference.
Right? That is great because suddenly he did if not live in that house you talked about before, he'd been there.
Yeah, he had been, he had always been a little bit of a squish on criminal justice issues. But, after he got mugged, he became a lot more conservative on some of these issues. And so, that's the kind of thing that, you can't really talk about, in the Washington Post.
Yeah.
Because, it's a little bit of, armchair pop psychology. But it is something that, like, lawyers who are about to argue in front of Stephen Breyer are thinking about. Right? Yeah. So that was that. That's kind of a great above the law type story for me. And I did that for, like you said, I did that for 12 years. I started off as the deputy editor, and I rose to executive editor, and the site's still going strong. I still know all the people there. It was a great website. I left only because, you know, as the Trump era, you know, became what it is, as it got really going, and I had been in ATL for so long, I felt that some of what I knew and some of what I was talking about needed to be expressed to a wider audience.
Sure. Kind
of, the lawyers already knew. Like, the lawyers already know that Barr is a problem, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I needed to be in a position where I could explain that to non-lawyers and explain legally why Barr is a problem and that kind of stuff. So that's why I left. But it was hard to leave. It's a great site. I love those people.
No, I was very surprised, you know, I was so surprised that when I first went to the site, I thought there must be more than one above the law. And I only say that because here you are, you know, tough justice correspondent for The Nation. And this looked so pop, so, you know, so mainstream in its, you know, niche, but very mainstream. But I think it's interesting to become so conversant in all of that and then say, but wait a minute. I got to do more. I got to do something else. Do you fear, let me just ask you before we move on, do you fear for the survival of publications and outlets like The Nation?
Absolutely. Look, so I have two versions of an answer here, Terrence, and it's they're almost contradictory, so you got to bear with
me. Okay. Right. Here's a lawyer for you.
Right. On the one hand, yes, I am terrified. Media is under attack, not just from the president, but just from the general market economic forces. You know, Facebook, the kind of early 2000 decision to just allow Facebook to be the de facto publisher,
yeah,
right, to be the de facto distributor of news, was a terrible decision that the country is suffering for, and certainly publications are suffering for as well. The old business model doesn't work. Advertisers are not willing to pay as much for online as they were for print. So a lot of the old business models are falling apart. The kinds of things, one of the things about above the law is that we made money. I used to sit 6 feet away before social distancing from my CEO, right? Like, I was on calls with my publisher trying to get advertising dollars, right? Like, I was, as an editor, intimately involved in making sure we were doing the kinds of things we needed to do to make money. The old model of, like, a wall between, like, that just doesn't work, really. So I fear for mainstream publications, for legacy publications, for all of those reasons. On the other hand. I don't have a job without the internet, right? Like, I couldn't be who I am without the internet. And in my early career, I was one of the disruptors, right? Going online only as opposed to print, pioneering some of these content plays and ad plays and whatever. You know, I've been on, as a niche startup site, you know, I've kind of been on the ground for a lot of the initial disruption from legacy media to what used to be called new media, right? And I think what I've learned from that is that adaptation has always been necessary in media. And if anything, media getting a little bit too slow, a little bit too long in the tooth, a little bit too lead-footed has been part of its own destruction.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, we need to be more live and agile and, you know, accepting the change and accepting to new voices, right? There are people that, you know, I have my career because at the end of the day, I've always brought clicks. And there are journalists who think that that's a terrible way to think. And it's not like I write to get clicks. It's not like I don't clickbait or that kind
right.
of stuff. But I am aware that... You know, I don't get to be kind of loud, vociferous, Black Lives Matter justice correspondent If I don't also make people go clickety clickety click, that's just a reality of the space. And I think that people who there are voices who can bring clicks. There are voices who can help us move forward into, I guess we're at like Web 5.0 now, who have been traditionally kept out of media. We need to bring those voices in, and a little bit of disruption is when those voices get to come in.
Yep.
So I am afraid that media will not handle disruption well. I am not afraid of disruption.
Yeah. Let me tell people, this is Freeform, a world that just might work. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Ayman Mistal. He's the justice correspondent at The Nation magazine. We're talking about the movement for racial justice, the Trump bar assault on the Constitution, and you can learn more at thenation.com. Let me ask you one other big question. When I read justice correspondent, I said, you know, I'm going to go look up the definition of justice. How do you think of justice?
So I asked for this title. This is my favorite title I've ever been given. All in my entire career, including when I was a lawyer. Justice is the fight for fairness, in my eyes. It is the fight for fundamental fairness. That is the fight. When I use the word justice as opposed to fairness, it's because I want to have. I think about fairness in a more legal way, right? The fight for legal fairness, the fight to make sure that our laws and regulations are fair. But when I think about what I cover fairness, and I cover people trying to get there.
Very good. Fairness. And that, by the way, was the word that I wrote down as kind of, a bunch of them in different dictionaries and so on, but fairness seemed to be the one. And it seemed to me, given that it stretched well beyond, and I understand that's why you chose it as your title, well beyond crime or well beyond government or politics or any of that. It's fairness.
Absolutely.
in society.
And look, the law is involved in everything. I mean, one of the things that you were talking about, what I learned about the law. One of the things that I've learned throughout my career is that if you peel, there is not a thing that happens in this country that there isn't a law kind of letting it happen at some point. If you peel back, it's like the human body. You peel back enough layers, you will get to a bone. You will get to a bone that it's all, that everything else is hanging off.
Right.
And that's the law in our country. The law are the bones of our country. Some of them are broken. Some of them are useless. Some of them are dangerous. But everything that we do in society is hanging off one of these bones of our laws, and we have to understand the laws if we're ever going to understand everything else, right?
Well,
we have to.
It seems to me that one of the things we wrestle with this president and this administration is what isn't covered by the law. What do you think of the norm, and I believe it is only a norm and not the law, that the president cannot be indicted or charged with a crime?
Exactly. I mean, look, this is what, I am not a particularly spiritual or religious man, but if I were, I would say that Trump has been sent here to teach us the difference between a norm and a law. And it turns out so much of our country works on norms. So much of our country works on the good faith of others, right? For a long time, but this predates Trump. For a long time, the way Republicans have won is by breaking norms. Democrats hold fast to norms. Democrats, I like to do the analogy of Democrats run around with a book and Republicans are willing to burn the book.
Yeah.
Right? This has been going back for at least 30 years now, where Republicans have simply refused to act in good faith. And so much of our country, as Trump has proven now without beyond a reasonable doubt, so much of our country relies upon the presumption of good faith, the presumption that everybody is trying their best, the presumption that we don't need to codify this, that, and the other thing into a legal document because good faith will prevail. And Trump has shown us just how little good faith is worth.
Yeah.
So one of the
That 30 years that you talk about, and I was thinking, I thought to myself, but what about Nixon and all of that? And in my own thinking, as you were speaking, I thought, well, there was a difference in that there were Dirksens and Bakers and people who would actually uphold the norms and the laws, and that is what has disappeared.
I'll tell you why, I think. I mean, it's this country's original sin, you know, is slavery. Racism is our original kind of moral failing. But it didn't stop 400 years ago. It didn't stop in 1865. It still exists today, and it still makes us dumb today. Racism will make people do stupid things. And I think that one of the difference between the Bakers and the Goldwaters, even in the Nixon era, who were willing to oppose a member of their own party versus the Republicans that we have now, is that back in Nixon's day, the thought of black people being truly equal to whites, being truly having a full equal share in the power and the money and the wealth of this country, was still mainly a dream, mainly a thought, you know, mainly something out there beyond the horizon that they didn't have to worry about. It was still a world for and by white men in the Nixon era. In the Trump era, coming on the heels as it did of the first black president, I think what we've seen, you can't explain Trump without understanding the racist reaction, I call it overreaction, some people have called it white lash, against having the first black president, against this world that's new to them, where, oh my goodness, black people might actually be in power someday. This replacement theory that we see from the white supremacists in Charlottesville and what have you, that's just, the Charlottesville people are just the most kind of grossest and most metastasized version of that. White people, there are white people in this country who live in fear of becoming a minority race in this country. And that explains Trump. That explains the Republican Party.
Yeah.
That explains why they are willing to do whatever, to look the other way on Trump.
That's right. If that explains Trump, and what you see if you are a Republican is the because of how you talked about its source, is the passion and the self-identification with Trump and his beliefs, that I think it's the intensity of that that leads them to not cross him.
Absolutely. Trump is their wall.
Yeah.
Trump is their wall.
And you know, one thing, I was in a conversation just yesterday about race over the last, you know, some of the same things we're talking about, and it occurred to me that this action-reaction thing is both so predictable and so intense that the civil rights movement and the civil rights legislation produced the Southern strategy of Nixon. And then we finally, 50 years later, we have a black president, and that produces Trump. That the movement produces an equal and opposite reaction.
The Democratic candidate for president has not carried the majority of the white male vote since the passage of the Civil Rights Act.
Ellie?
Yep.
You have to say that again. I have mentioned that, you know, several times in this program, but I'm sure people don't know it. Tell people that again.
The Democratic candidate for president, the nominee of the Democratic Party, has not won the white male vote in a general presidential election since the passage of the Civil Rights Act.
Yeah.
Not since Reagan, not since the Southern, that just the passage of that act is what lost white male Americans from the Democratic Party. No Democratic candidate, whether they won the presidency or not, won the white male vote since the passage of the Civil Rights Act. Obama, people are like, oh, Obama's post-racial, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
Obama lost white men 61-39 to Mitt Romney.
Wow.
He only got 43% of the white male vote, of the white vote, which included white women, when he won. In 2008 against McCain. Right? White people always voted against Obama. A majority of white voters always voted against Obama. People forget this. A majority of white voters always voted against Clinton. And name, and you can go down the list from Kennedy on through, from LBJ on through. After the passage of the Civil Rights Act, the Democrats have never won the white male vote.
Right. And I mean, and it is.
That's not an accident, folks.
What'd you say? It's not
That's
an accident.
It's not an accident. Folks.
Exactly. Exactly. I know. And when you see people, supposedly smart people saying, you know, you gotta lure back some of those black white voters who felt disenfranchised and had grievance and blah blah blah. You point out, wait a minute, conserve your energy. Those people have never, as you point out, right. have never voted for a Democrat since they passed the Civil Rights Act.
Went back, man. They ain't never been here.
Yeah. Okay. Let's jump here. Your take on the Mueller investigation, its conclusion, its effect.
What a failure. Just failure. I guess we should start with Mueller if you're gonna ask this question. The key problem with the Mueller investigation was that Bob Mueller himself is an institutionalist. It's not that he's a Republican. I mean, he is a Republican. That wasn't the problem. The problem is that he is an institutionalist. The problem is that he believes that the institution is more important than kind of anything else. And so at the end of the day, Mueller played things by the book. And while that, I'm sure, will earn him points in FBI heaven or whatever.
Like, you know what? It'll earn him points in bipartisan heaven.
Right? I'm sure, you know, bipartisan Peter is like, great job, Bob. But here on the ground, Trump does not care about your institutions. He doesn't care about your norms, and neither do any of the Republicans. So once the decision by Mueller to play it by the book itself sowed the seeds of his own defeat. Yeah. That's why... That was never, it turned out that was never going to go anywhere because as, and you already mentioned it, Terrence, the OLC, that's the Office of Legal Counsel, they have a memo, some guidance, they have an idea that the president cannot be prosecuted while he's in office. That is an idea. That is not in the Constitution.
I know.
Nowhere in the Constitution is that said. That is the OLC's opinion. And once Mueller decided that he was going to follow the OLC's opinion, all was lost. Nothing was going to come of it, right?
Yeah.
Now, it didn't have to be as pathetic as it was. And one of the reasons why it was pathetic as it was, which I'm sure we're going to get to next, is William Barr.
Exactly. My next question was, the Trump administration has always been dangerous. Always. But Trump found his partner in crime when he hired Bill Barr.
I try to be, as much as I hate the past, I try to be forward-looking. And what Bill Barr has been sent to show us, again, not a religious person myself, but what Bill Barr has been sent to show us is how stupid it's always been to have the Attorney General, the top lawyer, the top prosecutor for the government of the United States be a part of the President of the United States cabinet, serve at the pleasure of the President of the United States. The President has his own government lawyer. It's called the White House Counsel. Don McGahn, last seen ignoring congressional subpoenas, formerly held that post. Paul Cipollone, last seen advancing the President's ridiculous case against impeachment, currently holds that post. The President has his lawyer. The Attorney General is supposed to be our lawyer.
That's right.
But Bill Barr does not act like that. This is a problem that we should have fixed after Nixon. After Nixon fired his way to Robert Bork to do the Saturday Night Massacre. That's when the whole nation should have been like, maybe we shouldn't make the Attorney General fireable by the president. If, you know, maybe that would be a better way to protect our laws. But we didn't fix it after Nixon because, again, good faith, good faith, good faith. And now Trump finally found, as you said, Terrence, his partner in crime.
Yeah. By the way, if people don't recall, John Mitchell Attorney General, actually was sentenced to 19 months in prison. The bar for most corrupt attorney general is high, but I think Barr has passed that bar.
I think easily. Not just most corrupt, but literally most dangerous, right? Like, there aren't a lot of attorney generals that I can think of who would gas a group of peaceful protesters so their boss could take a photo op.
Yeah.
Right? That's a level of depravity that we haven't seen before, quite frankly. People forget, I'm going to date myself a little bit, but I remember when people freaked out about Janet Reno. I remember when there was a religious cult hauled up in Waco.
Yeah.
There were people who needed medication being held. Some thought hostage, some thought willing hostage. By the Branch Davidians in Waco, Texas. And Reno sent in the FBI. And people were hurt, right? People, blood was spilt that day. And Reno, Clinton's attorney general, one of Bill Clinton's attorney generals, took a lot of heat for that decision, for risking lives against religious, against people who, while kind of in violation of various laws, were not kind of attacking anybody. They were peaceful, right? They were defending themselves. They weren't, out, marauding on the streets. Sending in troops, basically, to stop them was a decision that was heavily criticized in real time when it happened. Bill Barr did worse than what Janet Reno did, right? Because Bill Barr doesn't even have the excuse of, I was trying to get some sick kids some medicine.
Right, right.
Bill Barr straight up gassed peaceful protesters, marched on peaceful protesters so Trump could take a photo op.
Yeah.
We haven't, that's a new one.
Yeah.
That's a
new one. And the way of the Justice Department really, I mean, Mitchell, covered up Watergate, but the Justice Department actually being an arm of the election campaign is phenomenal. Let me ask you this. You talk about the GOP Department of Justice's tendency to open investigations into presidential political enemies. Gonzalez did it, and currently there are at least two. Barr's Justice Department is investigating the Mueller report, Deep State, this Obamagate thing that they can never seem to describe, and possibly the Bidens. Do you fear an October surprise?
From the DOJ?
Yeah.
Not so much. Not so much. I mean, look, I need to qualify it slightly again. I'm going to be a lawyer for a second. They'll do something, right? Hunter Biden is indicted. Well, they'll have something. Maybe the best way of putting it, Terrence, is I think they have planned an October surprise. It's just that they've done such a bad job of keeping it secret that it's not really a surprise, right?
That's true.
Right? Like, you're going to indict Hunter Biden. Yeah, I know. Okay.
Yeah, right.
Duh. Right? People have already kind of understood, metastasized, internalized, the Burisma story, so that I don't think that it can be metastasized against Joe Biden the way that they thought.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's not... Yeah, I'm sure they're planning something. I just think that what they're planning is so already out in the open that it will land, that surprise will land like a thud, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I get that, yeah. So let's talk a bit about...
Oh, you bought exactly what I wanted off of my Amazon wish list. I'm so surprised. Like,
let's talk about the response to the killing of George Floyd. One of the senses I have is that this national outpouring of support has a bit of a root in the sense of shared vulnerability that people feel based on the pandemic. And so there was like a feeling in people already that when they witnessed, because of that 17-year-old girl's video, when we all in a way together witnessed that happen, it just, the response was, I think, greater, deeper, et cetera, than anyone anticipated.
I think, Terrence, one of the things, it's good because we were talking about media earlier. One of the real differences between our media age and, you know, my parents' media age, you know, 50 years ago, Walter Cronkite, you know, play-by-play on the moon. Everybody watched Walter Cronkite do the play-by-play of the moon landing, right? Because there were three goddamn channels. It was like, you watch that, or like you had to read a book or something, right? Those are your options, right? In the modern world, we have so many different options, so many different channels, so many different distractions, so many different things to watch that it's very rare that we are all watching the same thing at the same time. But because of coronavirus, because of quarantines, when Floyd was killed, we were all trained to be watching the news at the same time. No, we weren't out at the bar. We weren't watching the game. We were all kind of at home with our families, watching the same thing, having to explain the same thing to all of our kids. Not just, like, I'm black. I always have to explain that to my kids. But, like, white people have to explain it to their white kids, right?
Yeah.
They usually don't have to do. They can usually just ignore it. Oh, you know, little Billy didn't see that. He was out on the ball field when Michael Brown was murdered or when Trayvon Martin was shot, right? But he was home, you know, watching the television with you for 8 minutes and 46 seconds. And so now you have to explain it to little Billy. Why does that happen? So I think that because of the quarantine, it really was this maybe one of the last moments in American history where we were all watching the same thing at the same time. And that's one of the reasons why we've had this reaction.
Yeah, and one of the things that I feel is even if we didn't watch it at exactly the same time, because of the way the media and social media and the internet works now, within 24 hours, right? In other words, within 24 hours, we all witness the same thing. And because of a 17-year-old girl shooting on her phone, we witnessed it as it happened. I mean, so often, like with Michael Brown and so on, you know, we get reports and people don't, but this one, we were there, we saw it, we saw him with his hand, we saw Chauvin with his hand in his pocket. It's like we saw it.
The camera phone has changed the game. You know, the camera phone has not made more police brutality happen.
That's right.
It has made people able to see police brutality. Turns out, black people were not lying to y'all the entire time, right? Turns out, we were always telling the truth, but the camera phone finally allows people to see it.
So, what would be some of your solutions to the police brutality, militarization of police, overuse of police, etc.?
I mean, look, because of my legal training, I start with the law. I think you end qualified immunity or you're not really doing anything.
Explain to those who don't know what qualified immunity is.
Qualified immunity means that if the officer is acting within the line of duty, basically, right? He's doing his job, then he can't be sued for it. He can do his job poorly or correctly. He can do his job bad or good. But if he's doing his job, he can't be sued for it. And there are good reasons for qualified immunity to exist. I mean, it wasn't, it's not the worst rule in the world, conceptually. But how it's played out on the streets, it's the worst rule in the world, right? How it's played out on the streets, it means that cops feel like they can act with impunity. If you think about it this way, when you get so you got the dead black person, you've got the criminal case, which usually goes nowhere because a cop is, held to the standard of a jury of his white peers, not his black victims, not the peers of his black victims. So cop will often get off if he's prosecuted at all. And then there will be a civil suit, right? But the civil suit comes at the police department. Everybody gets to pay then, right? And the police departments almost always settle because they almost always have no ground to stand on in civil court. So they almost always settle. A lot of times families of the victims will get, $1 million settlements or whatever. That comes out of the corporate tax, of the collective tax base, because the suit is against the police department. They can't sue the actual officer. Now, if they could sue the actual officer, I guarantee you there'd be a lot less police brutality. if the actual cop was on the hook, not just for his job, but for his house, right? For his pension, right? For his Cadillac. I guarantee you there'd be a lot less police brutality. So I
actually misunderstood, I think, this qualified immunity. It doesn't make them immune to prosecution or being charged with crime, only with being sued.
Yeah, I mean, look, you can always charge a cop for murder. You have to get the prosecutor to get on the board with that. You have to argue that it happened, you know, the offense happened kind of outside the official duties of the book, right? But, you know, qualified immunity, right now Derek Chauvin is charged with, what, 2 counts of murder?
Yeah. I think.
Qualified immunity, yeah, we should Google that, but he's been charged with I think some count of homicide.
Yeah, at least one.
Right? Qualified immunity does not stop that charge from happening. It's not how Chauvin gets off from that. You can't beat a murder rap with qualified immunity. You can just there are other ways that cops get out of that. It stops them from qualified immunity stops them from being liable for their conduct in a civil court of law. Right, so it means that with qualified immunity, you have to rely on literally the state prosecutor to bring the charges. You can't do it yourself. That's why qualified immunity is why the cops who killed Breonna Taylor are still free, right? Mm-hmm. Because we can't get the prosecutor to do anything about it, and we can't sue them for their actions because of qualified immunity.
Got it. So the first step is that there's codes of silence, there's relationships between prosecutors and police and so on. So that makes the criminal charge piece challenging, and then you don't have the other arm. If people remember, O.J. Simpson got off in the criminal proceedings and lost in the civil.
And Terrence, one other thing about this, because you brought up the code of silence, qualified immunity would also help us pierce the veil of the code of silence. Because, again, remember, there were 4 or 5 officers involved in the George Floyd murder. If you have one of them who doesn't want to lose his house and his car and his pension,
yep,
flip on the other ones. That's how we brought down the mob, man.
Yep.
Like that's how you break omerta. You put people under such legal pressure that it becomes stupid for them not to tell the truth about their associates. And then the whole kind of facade crumbles down.
Yeah, the house of cards just falls.
Was one of those things that's protecting the house of cards as opposed to letting us pierce the veil of that house.
So do away with qualified immunity. And it strikes me that that one actually may have a possibility. Do you agree?
It's weird because there is, one of the reasons why I'm on this trip is to fight the Federalist Society. the arch-conservative group of lawyers who is responsible for most of the Trump judge appointments and, you know, Antonin Scalia's and Neil Gorsuch's. These people I fight a lot. But at the fringe end of the hard right, there is a nexus between hard right libertarianism and Black Lives Matter. There really is. There's a civil libertarian nexus there. So I like to say that we are not allies on this, but we like the same girl. and qualified immunity is one of those nexuses where for various kind of ideological reasons, there are people on the right who hate qualified immunity just as much as I do from the left. And so I do, you know, Neil Gorsuch, for instance, has made noises about qualified immunity being a bad thing. So when you say that's one of the things that can happen, that's why. It's one of the things that can happen because there is a strange kind of bipartisan support around the idea of getting rid of qualified immunity.
Very good. Briefly or quickly, beyond qualified immunity, what else? I mean, a lot of the talk is in defunding is to move funding around and to redefine, as I say, reimagine public safety and redefine the roles and practices that we ask of police.
Right. So I'm not, as this issue goes, I am not huge on the defunding side. I get it. I, you know, support it, and there are versions of it that I support. When I say I'm not huge on the defunding side, I'm like, I don't think that that is the first solution. It might be a final solution, but I don't think that's the first solution. One solution that I feel like we haven't tried yet is prosecuting cops who kill people. Literally, before we defund and before we blah, 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 we could just try actually prosecuting cops who kill and beat people, because that happens far, far, far too rarely. You know, the cops who killed Breonna Taylor had multiple things on their records of brutality. Why were they still on the force? Because there was no prosecution, right? The way our system currently works, the prosecutors work in cahoots with the police on all other crime. So when it comes time to turn around and prosecute the police for crime, they're always reluctant. They're never willing to do it, right? We need an independent investigation, an independent body that's in charge of prosecuting all police misconduct, not just murder, although especially murder, but all police misconduct. We need better ways of getting bad cops off the force. We need to, and I say this as a lefty union guy, we need to thwart the power of police unions and their abilities to keep bad cops on the beat. You want to take a cop who's been accused of 10 different, brutality violations and put them behind a desk for 2 years while you sort it out, I can kind of live with that. What I can't live with is that cop getting to walk the streets for 2 years while you sort it out. Because that's 2 years where he's going to beat me up. We haven't even tried. So when I talk about defunding the police, I'm not saying that's a bad idea. I'm just saying we haven't even tried just using law, right? We haven't even tried prosecuting these people.
The laws that are on the books.
Right, exactly. Yeah. We haven't tried
that linkage, that partnership, if you will, between prosecutors and police departments. I don't think people think about that enough, and we don't have time to go into it in depth, but given the absolute overload, overwhelming overload that our local courts serve under, this partnership is a way to just get through what has to be gotten through, and this is a side effect or a consequence.
Absolutely, Terrence. You know, one of the ways to fix this is by electing better district attorneys in your town. People don't understand that district attorney, your local district attorney election, is actually where you get to vote on how the cops will be treated.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can elect a district attorney who is going to be nice to the cops, or one who is going to view the cops with healthy skepticism. I always support DA candidates in my towns that promise at least healthy skepticism, right? There are hero DAs that we are seeing kind of pop up around the country. Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, Wesley Bell in St. Louis. Like, there are people who are starting to get around this fight, but we have to vote. We have to know who the good ones are. A lot of these times we have to vote in Democratic primaries, right? Because a lot of what I'm talking about happens in cities that are overwhelmingly blue. So it's actually the primary where these battles get fought. In my personal town, I had a DA primary where the current DA was involved in a scandal of covering up police corruption. Literally, he had gotten a tape with police on tape talking about planting evidence on victims. And he covered it up for a year. He was running as a Democrat. He lost, but
But he got that far.
Right, you have to pay. He was the sitting DA. You have to pay attention to these people. And so, that is also a way to kind of stop police brutality. You want to stop police brutality, check the people who are holding the leash and vote for people who are going to yank it.
Yeah, and the notion that elected DAs, elected prosecutors, and so on can have their campaigns funded by police unions, that's that's
so wrong. So
that's ripe for abuse. I'll tell you what, I certainly have a list of topics we haven't gotten to yet, and it includes the Supreme Court and the election. And given the time we've got left, I'm just going to ask you to talk a bit about the election. If I give you 2 minutes, talk about the election.
So what the courts are doing up and down, whether it's a federal court or a state court, they are refusing to allow extensions to absentee or mail-in voting requirements, right? So in Michigan, just yesterday, we're recording this on a Friday, just yesterday, the Michigan State Supreme Court ruled that it wasn't going to hear an appeal about whether absentee ballots had to be received by 8 p.m. on election day, right? This is huge because more people will be voting by mail than ever before. Most people will be voting by mail for the first time. A lot of people will not know that essentially if they do not vote by mail 2 weeks before election day, their vote won't be counted in some states. So the effort to extend those deadlines to make it easier, certainly any effort to mail absentee ballots out, all of those efforts have been curtailed, if not outright squashed, by the Supreme Court or lower courts. Their plan to steal the election is to make people feel like they have the option of voting absentee, but then not get their votes in on time so that their votes don't have to be counted. That is the plan.
Yeah, and
the way to solve for that, the way to combat that, unfortunately, you have two options. One, you've got the people who know that they need to vote 2 weeks in advance, which means they know they need to request the absentee ballot months ago. I've requested my absentee ballot for the November election in June. All right?
Yeah, and I'm in California where I automatically get it. Good for us.
Right, good for you guys. New York is not as progressive, quite frankly, on voting rights. So we either have to kind of have that planning in place, or people on election day are going to have to go out of their homes and risk their lives to vote.
Yeah, I know. I've seen you speak about this, and you say, you know, to say when people who are dealing with a pandemic, dealing with a risky job or no job, dealing with their kids at home, dealing with all of this stuff, taking care of their parents, that you say, well, you should have applied for your absentee ballot sooner, is something you can say. But democracy and the right to vote should supersede being a school marm.
Voting is not supposed to be hard, folks.
That's right.
It's supposed to be easy and automatic, and Republicans have spent, you know, decades making it not so.
Yeah. The only way you rule is minority rule. That's what you got to do. Yeah. I'll tell you what we didn't talk about. We didn't talk about the use of federal secret police, and we didn't talk at the Supreme Court. And maybe we can set one of these up again soon and continue this conversation. But we got to bring this one to a close, Ellie.
Terrence, have me back in October when the court's back in session, and we'll talk about what the hell they're doing this term.
Great. Okay, so again, you can learn more about and see all of Ellie Mistal's work at thenation.com. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website, A World That Just Might Work, or Terrence McNally, TerrenceMcNally.net. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 10 articles to flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, and most major podcast sites. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at those others, Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice. You can also follow me on Twitter, at McNally Terrence. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Ellie Mistal, and keep up your good work.
Thank you so much for having me.